24/7 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. We got a great show for you today. First up, we have Emily Kesrell. She is from Australia and is an expert on listening. So we're going to talk today about her topic, deep listening. And then after that, one of our greatest hits is we rebuild all of the files that got knocked off our old server. And we're rebuilding on the new server now and getting the great interviews back up. Vern Harnish will be with us. He is the EO, Entrepreneur Organization founder, and is one of the biggest pillars in the entire entrepreneurship space. EO is an incredible organization. If you need to get connected with other entrepreneurs, I don't think there is a better organization out there. And so you should join. Appreciate you being with us today. We're going to go ahead and get started in just a second. Remember, go buy my new book, The Real Environmentalist. It talks about all of the people doing harm instead of good and the people doing good that you've never heard of. It is a great book. We'll be right back to get started.
Bye.
To us if you have any questions or comments, or if you need help with your business at any stage, from concepts to exit. Jim accepts all connections on LinkedIn. He tweets from @EntrepreneurJim, and he responds to emails at james.beach@att.net. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy the show.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to introduce my first guest. Please welcome Emily Kesrell to the show. She is a deep listening expert, has a new book out called Deep Listening, and has spent her entire career in the listening world. She was a BBC journalist, award-winning journalist, and also a producer there, and worked in the arts and I think religion. I was the head of the departments there, arts and religion, I believe. And has now gone out on her own. She's coaching, writing incredible books, and helping others to become better listeners. Emily, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thank you so much, Jim. Delighted to be here.
Really delighted to have you. So briefly, tell us what deep listening is. Is it just being a good listener?
Well, often we think we're good listeners, but you know what we're doing? We're performing the act of listening. But what we're actually doing is we are preloading our verbal gun with ammunition, ready to fire. Or we listen only long enough to interrupt somebody and tell them why they're wrong, how we can provide the solution to their problems, or how we can cheer them up.
Yeah, I don't really like your definition, Emily.
Yeah, you relate to that, huh?
No, I was just interrupting you. You said that the bad people interrupt, so I had to interrupt.
Well, I tell you something. I was a serial interrupter and asked my family. I still do interrupt sometimes. But you know what's so exciting? When you don't interrupt and you let silence sit, then suddenly whole new thoughts that you would have never imagined can unfold, especially when you use the other steps, 8 steps of deep listening. And that is really exciting because not only do you learn something new, but the speaker is able to think new thoughts that they never even imagined.
All right, so let's go through the 8 steps. You want to start off with create space, number one?
Yeah, step one, create the space. So this is thinking about the physical environment. Overhead, blue-white lights, not so good. A lot of glass and metal, not so good. Very echoey. What works better is a space maybe with a bit of material, a bit of wood, and more side lights, more yellowy lights, but even more importantly, so that the speaker feels psychologically safe. So, for example, if you're in a open plan office, not the best to really hear from one of your colleagues of why they've got issues with timekeeping. Better to go to someplace where they feel safe. Better even a walk in outside, and even better a walk in nature. And step two is about listening to yourself first. Because particularly when you disagree or it's a difficult conversation, what happens when you try and listen that you have all these shadows in yourself, all the unresolved parts of yourself that you project onto your speaker. So you're no state to listen to them. So in the book, which I've actually also illustrated, the Deep Listening book, I actually paint a picture of someone desperately trying to listen, but there are all these shadows causing chaos in their body. Let's say you're listening to your boss, but actually you're not listening to your boss. You know what you're listening to? You're listening to your bullying older brother, and you're not an adult. You are 8 again, and that's what it feels. And when you're feeling defensive, you're in no space to listen. So if you listen to yourself first and figure out what's really going on, take the time to emotionally prepare yourself, you'll be in a much better place to listen to someone else. And step 3 is about being present. Often people tell me they don't have time to listen properly. And by the way, when I coached executives in Hollywood, they said to me, we don't do this deep listening. That's my bad American accent. We don't do this deep listening. We don't have time for that. We come
good
up
accent,
with quick and
accent.
Ritty retorts. And, you know, people feel pressed, but actually, of course, time is important. But what's even more important is the quality of attention that you do give in the moments and minutes that you do have. So take time to, you know, still yourself, to enable yourself to be present so that you can really open up. For the research of the book, I spent time with First Nation people in Canada. And when I was listened to by them in the middle of the forest, just not too far from the Rockies, there was such a sense that they were open to whatever was overlap. There was such a sense to me that they were open to whatever I had to say in whatever way it would unfold. And that made me feel safe enough to express myself and be really open with them. Step 4 is about being curious. So often when we listen, we assume that we already know what the speaker is going to say. So we go, I get you. And in fact, my daughter said to me the other day, I just read in your book, Mom, don't assume that I'm going to tell you the same things I said last year, last week, or last night. And she was right, because we are all in the process of becoming. We're all in a process of constant change. And so we need to be curious, as if this is in a once-in-a-lifetime encounter, and we might find out something that really surprises us. And I should say with deep listening, this isn't for every conversation. I mean, if I were to ask you, would you like a cup of tea? And you were to really be present and ponder for like, you know, a minute or two, I'd probably throw the tea in your face. Deep listening is for conversations that really matter, or when we disagree with somebody, or there's a relationship which needs repair. So when we are curious, step 4, it allows us to feel more empathy for the person who is speaking, because we learn more about them. And out of that can flourish respect. And this is respect for the person, for their humanity, but not necessarily for their ideas or beliefs. It's fine that we don't agree when we listen. We want to separate the ideas of listening and agreeing. And step 5 is the gaze, because it's so important when we listen. I know we're having this conversation without being able to see our body language. Actually, tone of voice is more reliable than facial expression to know what somebody's feeling. But if you're able to continue to look somebody in the eye, but that's not a like gaze like Michel Foucault, the French philosopher, who got prison officers to make their prisoners feel subjugated. We're talking about a warm-hearted, open gaze that you give your speaker. And not, by the way, face-to-face, because that means you're either going to kiss them or fight with them. Angle of 60 degrees works far, far better, or even if you go for a walk. But just feel comfortable to continue to look them in the eye while they will look away and have new thoughts. And then they'll return knowing you're waiting for them. Step 6 is about holding the silence. So you feel comfortable with leaving a few seconds of silence. I mean, even in negotiation, there was a research paper came out 2021, silence is golden. And they found that when they asked two parties in a negotiation to give up to 20 seconds of silence, nobody did 20 seconds, by the way, but still, they found people who used even a bit of silence, they were much more likely to come out with win-win ideas and outcomes where both parties benefited rather than zero sum. If I win, you lose. And of course, again, this isn't the kind of silence to intimidate. We're talking about a warm, open-hearted silence. And that allows us also to really make sense of what the speaker has said, because step seven is reflect back. Now, you might have been on an active listening course where you go, I understand, and you paraphrase what they've said. Deep listening, reflecting back, is really quite different. And in the book, I give lots of tips on how to know what to reflect back. Because what you're doing is really... Shall I just switch my phone off? I'm so sorry. Let's just switch it right off. Okay. Because... Where was I? Reflecting back. Because in deep listening, reflecting back is not just the words. It's also the notes between the words and the emotions. And when you reflect back, that really gives not only a sense for the speaker that they've been understood, but even when you get it wrong, you offer it back with humility. So they'll say, it's not that, but it's this. And through that iterative process, so you reflect back and then they speak more and you reflect back, they get a chance to understand themselves more fully, you to understand them far better, and you both to become more connected to get to step eight, which is their deeper narrative, to really help understand their values, their motivations, what they care about, which brings you to a whole different understanding using what Theodore Reich, who was a pupil of Sigmund Freud, called your third ear. So it's like you don't just use your intellectual brain, you use another part of you, this little ear, which I like to think of as next to your heart, to really understand the core of what the speaker is saying.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 20. So I gave you your 20. When you say next to the heart, isn't that the gut? Isn't that the intuition of whether the person's being honest or not, and whether I respect this person or not, or whether I want to ask a question or not to follow up? I just maybe want to walk away at that point.
Yes, you're right. It's your intuition, but it's your intuition coming from a place of generosity. But sometimes it might be actually your gut. So, for example, if you are somebody in the office and you said to them, somebody who works, part of your team, and you say, is it okay? I just need this piece of work to be done. You need to get this project done and you need to get it done by Wednesday. And they go, yeah, sure. And their mouth is smiling, but not their eyes. And you could say, great, fantastic, I look forward to it. Or you could say, I'm sensing from you, that's your gut, your intuition, your third ear. I'm sensing from you that perhaps you have got a lot going on and you're not sure about getting this done by Wednesday, but maybe don't feel comfortable to share that with me. Is that right? And suddenly you're having a real genuine conversation. You've gone off script and you can find out whether they can do it, whether it means they've got to junk something much more important, or whether they can't do it. And you can have that conversation and then determine what next. So it doesn't only have to be really long conversations. It's, you know, using your gut is like naming the noise in the room, the stuff that we often ignore, but we have hunches around. And it's about offering it back with humility for them to agree or discard or to amend. Should we do a little demo and see what happens?
It's exactly what I was thinking. Demo, I heard you had a demo. Let's play it.
Okay. So let me ask you, Jim. Tell me, Jim, what food reminds you of home?
Waffles.
Waffles?
Yes, waffles.
And tell me more.
You know, Mom would always make waffles on the weekends, and you'd have real syrup and bacon and orange juice, and It was a sit-down meal where everyone would be there as opposed to eating cereal alone, watching TV is the other extreme.
And so I'm sensing that it wasn't just the food and the bacon and the syrup and everything that came with, but it was a sense of it being a time of togetherness rather than living, you know, watching TV, eating alone cereal, a time where you felt more treasured as a family.
A little bit, but mostly I just really like waffles. You know, those waffles are really good. I would have been upset if it was pancakes, for example.
And so it wasn't quite the family get-together, but it was the sense of the quality of the food that I feel you can almost taste as you're talking about it, that gives you an energy and a boost and a kind of almost nostalgia for growing up.
Yep, sure.
Is that right?
I enjoy the hell out of those waffles. I have a phobia, though, about syrup. If I touch syrup, I freak out.
And so it was the waffles that were just fantastic, but actually not the syrup. There's this very intense anti-reaction to it.
I use the syrup, but I put the napkin on the handle of the syrup and don't actually touch the syrup. And then I use the rest of the napkin like a glove over my hand so that there's no way I can get any syrup on me.
And so it's a kind of real mixed picture because the waffles were so sensually vital, a taste of them, absolutely. And at the same time, you had to deal with navigating the challenge of not letting the syrup touch your skin, which for you is super important. So you had a whole mechanism of napkin wrapped around the handle and so forth to make sure you felt safe.
I don't know what it's about feeling safe. I just don't like being sticky.
Okay, not so much it was the stickiness which just made you, you know, fear that. Is that right?
I'm not sure I understood that one, Emily.
It's that the stickiness. It was the stickiness that you felt at the time really phobic about.
And I still feel it. It hasn't gone away. Yeah, it's just you can't, once you get sticky, even washing your hands doesn't make you unsticky. You're still going to be sticky later. And then you're going to put your hand to your face and now your hand's going to be, your face is going to get sticky too. And then it just spreads like a virus.
So it's the sense for you that syrup, although you like the taste of it, represented a danger of stickiness, which would contaminate you, could get your fingers, your face, everywhere. Like you couldn't control it.
Well, I don't know if it's about control. I just know that the first level of hell is the syrup level.
Okay. Syrup level, first level of hell. Now, yes. How did that conversation feel like for you, Jim?
I think we should make that movie, The First Circle of Hell. Cereal. I mean, syrup.
How many questions, syrupy questions, did I ask you there, Jim? Roughly.
How many syrupy questions?
No, how many questions? How many questions, roughly?
10 at least.
I asked you two questions. I asked you what food reminds you of home. You told me waffles. You were giving no more away. So I asked you the second question, which was tell me more. Now, tell me more is the best other question you can ask, the secondary question, because it allows you to define what more is. Yeah? I let you be in charge of the conversation. You took me down the waffle and the syrup angle. I offered you the possibility of talking about your family as something you value, but you discarded that, and that was okay. You told me you wanted to talk about the taste of the waffle, and then you brought out the syrup. Now, when you talked about syrup, in my mind, I was thinking about Lady Macbeth, because if you remember in Macbeth, she says, "Ne'er will thy hands be clean." She kept trying to wipe the blood off her hands. And that was the metaphor in my head. But it was my metaphor, not yours. And had I, you know, it came to me, this Lady Macbeth metaphor, but I didn't move it, didn't bring it in, because then suddenly I'm taking you onto my track. I let you be in charge and go down your track. And from that, I learned a little bit about you and about something that I would have never found out had we discussed the waffle recipe or your family or any of the questions. Hey, I'm a journalist. I got loads of questions. So instead, I found out much more about you, perhaps more than you intended to tell. But it's not about being exploitative. The idea in deep listening is not manipulative. It's about genuinely being a better person, a better listener, allowing the other person to unpack what they want to unpack. And it's so important, actually, that you treat the material in confidence. Because imagine we're colleagues and suddenly I know this thing about you with syrup and, you know, or you could obviously tell me much worse. And that's why in the book I've got two chapters on ethics, how, when not to listen, and how to treat the material and treat your speaker, because they often get to trust you and share perhaps more than they had thought they were going to share at the start of the conversation.
I heard that you almost took Ethiopia to war.
Well, it is true. In my very early days as a BBC journalist, I was in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa, in East Africa, interviewing Meles Zenawi, who is the president of Ethiopia. And I was pretty proud of my great journalistic talent, you know, not very many years in. And so when I got to interview the president of Ethiopia, just not long, you know, the day before, I had been in the bar of the Gion Hotel, where lots of people hang out and stay. And these dissidents came to talk to me and we had a beer together and they told me about the really serious human rights abuses which had happened under the watch of President Meles Zenawi that he, they argued, knew about. So I wanted to put him, you know, hold him to account on behalf of the BBC and ask him these difficult questions. He wanted to talk all about his very significant progress about doing something around poverty in Ethiopia, about increasing the harvest of grains, of sorghum, of other grains in Ethiopia. I was not interested. I was not curious. I didn't really listen. I wanted to hammer home human rights abuses. After a while, he edged further and further away from me across his vast presidential desk. And then he said, okay, I've had enough. And he cut off the interview early. And I really missed an opportunity to hear a complex and interesting man from telling a really interesting story, because the interview just had very short replies and it finished early. And it was because I wasn't ready to listen. And it doesn't mean I was wrong to hold him to account, but we can do two things. We can listen, and then we can also hold people to account if necessary.
So, Emily, we've sort of made this connection, but I want you to really drive it home for us. How does using deep listening help our relationships with our family, friends, and foes? How do I use, so using the tell me more, how do I use that to get more out of that 14-year-old teenager that doesn't want to tell you anything?
Teens are really hard. Somebody told me with teens, you just got to be a pot plant that sits in the corner and waits to be talked to, but otherwise you just say shum. So it's not about getting them to talk. It's about, I think a different way to frame it perhaps is providing them the space to talk. Going in a teenager, by the way, in a car is often really good because they feel, you know, it's like they don't feel so much pressure and all the noise of the traffic gives them a chance just to think, and for you to talk or going for a walk can work really, really well with a teen. So it's not just the tell me more. It's also, if you remember step 7 and 8, the reflecting back, like I was reflecting back your story of the waffles and the syrup, because by reflecting back, I was reflecting back not just your thoughts, but also what I felt lay between them and your emotions. And this is critical. So if your kid, you know, comes back from school and says, hey, I had a horrible time and the teacher just picked on me nonstop. And if you were to say to them, oh, I'm sure it wasn't so bad. I'm sure they were also picking on other kids. I'm sure perhaps that was just the way you were feeling. They'll go, yeah, and walk away. That's when your teen doesn't talk to you. But instead, you can say, sounds like you had a pretty bad day at school and it felt like your teacher was just picking on you. Must be hard, must have felt hard. Notice that I didn't agree with a child saying the teacher picked on them. I said it felt like you felt like the teacher picked on you. So you're reflecting their feelings and your kid will go, yeah, it was really horrible. And the other kids just laughed at me and it just, you know, it just, yeah, I don't even want to go to school tomorrow. And then you can reflect back after giving them time to think, you know, sounds like that really hurt you, especially when other kids in the class just gave you a hard time. And then they might say, yeah, but it wasn't so bad, actually, because then I played with Harry's phone and we had a good game. And later, you know, because they've been heard, not just their words, but also their emotions, they are more likely to be in a place ready to move on and see the wider picture.
Emily, that was great. That demo, what you just did with the kid, was my favorite thing you've done. That was fantastic.
Shall I tell you another little story?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, it was just happened not so long ago at the pharmacy near my house in London, and I was picking up some drugs for my daughter, and there was a lady waiting for her drugs sitting on a plastic chair. So I said to the pharmacist, said to me, okay, so what's the birth date of your daughter? I want to check the drugs are right. So I go, it is 3rd of July, 21. And she said, are you sure? And I thought about it for a moment, and I said, wait a minute. No, it's the 3rd of July, 2001. Whereupon the lady in the plastic chair said, wait a minute, you don't know the age of your daughter. That's pretty silly. I bet she won't be pleased. And I replied, you're quite right. I think she'd be really annoyed if she, I didn't even know when she was born and how old she was. And then I started talking to the lady on the chair, and she told me about her grandmother who just had a milestone birthday in her 90s. And she said, yeah, I feel really proud. And I said, I sense that you feel proud, but there's also something else going on. And she replied, yeah, I think that I'm going to die before my grandmother. And we continued to talk just for a few minutes, and she told me about her condition, and she started crying, and then she apologized for crying, and I said it wasn't a problem. And then I went home, and she went home, but not before thanking me for listening to her. And I had a sense that she was carrying this heavy burden, and perhaps she hadn't, you know, she needed to talk about it. She needed to feel heard. And it just happened to be because I was willing to be humiliated a bit about the, you know, my daughter and not knowing her age, and be able to be present for her in order to pick up on that one word, enabling her to feel open, to be able to trust me and tell me what was going on. And then we went home. And, you know, the reason that I'm so motivated with this work in deep listening is for two real reasons, the two core reasons. The first is there's such an epidemic of loneliness in our society, particularly among young people, but not only young people, even within our own families. We all need to be heard. It's a fundamental human need and even a human right. And you, by going out and spending time learning a bit more about deep listening from my book and actually practicing it. If you read it only but don't practice it, it won't be worthwhile. It's about going out in the wild and practicing deep listening with your family, with your friends, and also wider in your community, with your neighbors, even with people you disagree with. Because in order to do something about the epidemic of polarization, we need to feel a little more confident to listen to people we disagree with. And that does not mean that we agree with them, and it does not mean that we will be contaminated by the overlap, and it does not mean we'll be contaminated by their ideas.
Emily Kasriel, thank you so much for being with us again. The book, Deep Listening. You can also go to emilykasriel.com, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's emilykasriel.com. So that's Emily. Yeah, that's K-A-S for Sierra.
You spell it.
Okay, it's Emily, and then it's K-A-S for Sierra, R-I-E-L for Lima.com.
Thank you so much for being with us. It was a great conversation. We'd love to have you back.
Okay, lovely to be here. Thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you, and we will be right back.
Tired of talk and no action on climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
Welcome back to School for Startups Radio. Thank you so much for being with us. I hope you're having a fantastic holiday season, getting ready for some family fun and festivities, some wonderful food, and getting ready to make your New Year's resolutions for a 2015 that is quickly coming upon us. I am very excited and honored to introduce you to my first guest today. His name is Vern Harnish, and he is the owner of a company called Gazelles, which does around-the-world entrepreneurship education. He is also the founder of EO, Entrepreneurs Organization, which is one of the best organizations out there, and he was the chair there for 15 years. He is also a syndicated columnist called The Growth Guy for a little publication you may have heard of called Fortune Magazine, and he has written one of the most definitive business books out there, and he's got a new update to it called Scaling Up, Mastering the Rockefeller Habits 2.0, Why a Few Companies Make It and the Rest Don't. Vern, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Jim, thanks for hosting me. I greatly appreciate it here at the end of 2014.
Well, did you have a good year as an entrepreneur, Vern? I know you're also a dad, you're also a writer, you're a husband, you're a magician. You have so many hats to wear. Let's talk about entrepreneurship. Good year, bad year, 2014 for Vern, the entrepreneur.
Yeah, you know, Jim, it was a great year. And though very, very busy, I think the whole world is obviously coming out of whatever slump we thought we were in. I think all signs point up with this big, you know, kind of bubble moving through the global economy, this 1.4 billion people moving into the middle class. So my view is, if you can't make more money, not that that's the only reason entrepreneurs are in business, but can't make more money this decade than you ever thought possible, you know, it's because we screwed up. The market's there. The customers are there.
I love it. I love it. It's up to us then. And is a new year a good time for resolutions? Are you a goal writer? Are you going to write down some new ideas for the next year? What are your recommendations as we move into a new year, Vern?
Well, we do, Jim. We, you know, the thing we're probably best known for from the original book, Mastering the Rockefeller Habits, is this one-page strategic plan. You know, we talk about as entrepreneurs, we got to get, you know, everybody on the same page, but, you know, you have to have the page for everybody to get on. And so we've had about 40,000 companies now use this on a regular basis. It's something I developed when I was chairing and running that executive program that we hosted at MIT for growth companies, and we're really excited. We've got a new tool we call the one-page personal plan, and we know that particularly as entrepreneurs, we've got to be clear what our own personal goals are, and by being clear, then it's much easier for us to align and set what are the company goals. And so we're excited about this new one-page tool and this kind of 15-minute daily routine that we've designed for people personally that mirrors this 15-minute daily huddle that, again, we've become well-known for to help people actually execute their plans in 2015 and beyond. All outlined in the new book.
Tell us about the one-page plan. What goes on there? What does not go on there? What are the important pieces?
Well, I think the first key is, at least there's not a lot of space to write. Now, if you can't state what it is that you're trying to accomplish simply from your core values to your purpose to those three brand promises that you're making to the marketplace, you know, the reasons to buy from you instead of someone else, and then ultimately, what is that single priority you're going to focus on in the next 12 months, in the next 90 days? That's all encompassed there on this one-page plan. And we have a tool we call the Vision Summary that lets you kind of summarize it so you can share it with everyone around the world. What we're really against, by the way, is these vision statements. You know, people write these kind of long paragraphs. They angst over them. And the reality is no one's going to remember it the minute it's been printed. And one of the reasons why we break our phone numbers up, you know, if somebody gives you seven numbers real quick instead of three numbers and then pause and then four numbers, you know, it's much harder to remember when it's all jumbled together. And so we like people to be very clear. These are our handful of core values that any startup ought to be, you know, aware of from the beginning. What is the why, the real purpose, the thing Simon Sinek has been pushing, you know, through his writing? What's this then big, hairy, audacious goal? You know, what's our Everest that we're gonna achieve? Where are we going in the next 10 years? And then a few more of these, like our brand promise and our priorities. That's it. And keep those separate. Don't jumble them together.
All right. What are the brand promises that really ring strong, Bern? Are there any like categories that we can copy from others? Any examples that we can use? What does a good brand promise look like?
Well, again, it's typically three things. It's not four. It's not two. That's Robert Cialdini, you know, the king of influencers work. If you're going to try to convince somebody to buy from you, a list of 10 is disastrous. And it's like Southwest Airlines, you know, from the day they launched, Jim, it's always been low fare. There's always one you lead with, and theirs is low fare. Then there's always two others that support it. Lots of flights. So it's one of the things that make them popular. If you miss the 5 o'clock, there's a 6 o'clock, a 7 o'clock, and an 8 o'clock that you can catch. They promise 8 flights a day between points. And then lots of fun. And so low fare, lots of flights. Lots of fun. They call it the 3LFs, or sometimes they shorten it to the 3Fs. And it's a really focused promise that they deliver on. My good friends over at Rackspace, Graham Wesson, student of mine at 1999, today, and the company's worth something around $6 to $7 billion. You know, they labeled their overall promise fanatical support. In fact, that became, you know, the key brand bigger than almost Rackspace. But underneath that were three very measurable, and that's the key. These things have to be measurable, not just hollow promises. And so they said, look, first thing we're going to do is promise uptime. You know, you want your servers to run, and I'm sure a lot of your audience uses, as we do, Rackspace's servers. Number two, if something does go bad, you want to be able to pick up the phone and not get an automated attendant, but you want it answered, and in their case, within three rings by a level two tech. Because that leads to number three, you do not want that call to be transferred. And so that's what they mean. It's very, very concrete. That's what fanatical support means. And Graham and the team have been able to take that company to something north of $6 billion in market cap with those three promises.
Are measurable goals always numeric then, Vern?
Well, there's different kinds of goals on the one-page plan. So if you're looking at something like a purpose, you know, Sony said, we really want to change the poor quality image of products in Japan. Now, at some point, yes, you can measure that and know when you maybe crossed over that point. So that's maybe a little fuzzier. But everything else on the one-page strategic plan, absolutely, you've got to be able to boil it down to hard metrics.
All right. How did you get started as an entrepreneur, Vern? Let's jump back to the beginning of the story just quickly. Did you leave school thinking you were going to be an entrepreneur? What was your background like?
Well, you know, I think it happens to a lot of entrepreneurs. It's kind of thrust upon you. And back when I launched, I'm 55, so this is many, many years ago, 40 years ago, in fact. First, it wasn't cool to be a young entrepreneur. I remember you know, the days when everyone's attitude was, I mean, the corporate man was still the goal, and parents' attitudes towards students, their children was, hey, that's cute, but when are you going to get a real job? But in our case, I grew up around entrepreneurs. My grandparents were entrepreneurs. My dad had a company, and then he and his partners lost it in the 73 recession. And on my 15th birthday in 1974, we moved out to Kansas, and I went from having this kind of beautiful, privileged life in Littleton, Colorado, to my dad and I jumping into a little business we launched, repairing appliances for Marvin Ryan in his Sears store, catalog star in Kinsley, Kansas. That was the start of it. Then did appliance repair business, got in the HVAC business, and the rest was history. And then in 83, co-founded this group called ACE, Association of Collegiate Entrepreneurs, while I was in college.
Tell us about that.
Well, that was fun. We, you know, again, it wasn't a real popular thing to be an entrepreneur, but the entrepreneurial movement was picking up at the colleges and universities, I think primarily because Steve Jobs. I've always considered Steve kind of the guy that finally proved to the world that a kid in his 20s could build a multi-billion dollar company. And so in 83, co-founded this group called ACE. Early participants, Michael Dell, Mark Cuban. 1986, I hosted the big event that was Steve Jobs' first public speech after being fired from Apple, something very, very painful, obviously, for him. And it was in that organization that we took worldwide that morphed in 1987 into YEO, Young Entrepreneurs Organization, which today is just called EO because all of us young folks turned old. And we got rid of the Y, and today it's the largest entrepreneur membership organization in the world. We got almost 11,000 members and 147 chapters and I think 42 countries or something like that.
All right, and why is it worth the money? It's not free. It's expensive. It's, I don't know, a couple thousand dollars a year or something. Why, Vern, should my listeners join EO? What will they get out of it? What is the intrinsic benefit?
Well, you know, I borrowed from my dear friend Joe Mancuso, who wrote one of the original kind of business plan books, this idea that it's okay to be independent, but no reason to be alone. And as you know, being an entrepreneur at the end of the day is a very lonely affair. You know, you quickly, you know, become almost alienated from your friends and you're often isolated away from your family because how busy you are. And there's things that you need to discuss with someone that only other entrepreneurs are going to understand. And so it's a place where we share and learn and grow and have some fun together. And more importantly, you have now got an unbelievable global network. There's not a city, Jim, I go to in the world where I don't have an instant connection and network if I need to get something done.
Well, that is valuable. That is incredibly valuable. How much time, you know, like with Rotary, Vern, you have to go every week and all of that. How much time will EO take up in my already busy calendar?
You're talking about a chapter meeting every month for a couple of hours. The most intensive aspect of EO is what's called the forum, where you're with seven or eight or nine other peers. And we meet for half a day every month, and that's sacrosanct. We put those days in our calendar a year in advance. You know, out of 12, you might miss one or two. That's okay. But generally, you keep to that half a day. And then, you know, usually two or three days a year, you attend one of the national or international or regional conferences where you kind of connect up with several hundred other of your peers. So that's kind of the time commitment. A few hours a month and a few days a year.
All right. Talk to us about your, or the second, the update of your book, Scaling Up, why a few companies make it and why the rest don't. I got to know, why did some companies make it and the rest don't, Vern?
Well, one of the things we've got at the scalingup.com website is folks can download for free the one opening chapter called Barriers. And it outlines the three key barriers that get in the way of almost every entrepreneur, and I've moved in almost 1,500 through that executive program at MIT, and we've got 2,000 active clients, you know, any one day, and they all face these same three barriers, and if you don't get over those, you're going to get stuck. And in fact, we set the barrier to get into EO at $1 million because only 4%, Jim, 4% of companies get over that hump. Only 0.4% get over the 10 million hump. So it becomes quite an elite crowd as you scale up. So there's three of these barriers that are outlined in that chapter.
All right. What are the barriers, Vern?
Well, simply, first, leadership development. Can you and your team and then ultimately your middle management grow fast enough to keep up with the growth of the organization? Normally, our companies outgrow our teams, and it's a sad, you know, situation. And you're so busy, you don't seem to have time to learn. And that's one of the reasons why EO is important for the CEO. And Gazelles has been a resource then for the rest of the team. The second is, do you have scalable infrastructure? Primarily processes. You know, we get so obsessed with our functions. You know, I got to grow a bigger sales function and got to get marketing going, and I've got my accounting function and IT. But real work cuts across those functions. And not enough entrepreneurs are obsessed with the details around process, so they end up getting really sloppy and just having to throw bodies at the problem. So the book deals with how you really reverse that situation. And then number three, it really boils down to marketing effectiveness. You know, if there's a general weakness in almost all growth companies, it's not having a well-functioning, I mean, on-fire marketing function separate from sales. And generally, because the entrepreneur is the one that's been driving marketing, whatever is their strength ultimately starts to become the weakness of the organization, because they get so busy doing so many other things that marketing starts to trail off. And that's the function that's to get you not just new customers, but people forget marketing is needed as much to attract talent and investors and publicity and attention as it does customers. So there's a lot of important things to get done. And if that's not a well-running function, the company is going to get stuck. So leadership development, scalable infrastructure, mainly through clean process, ease in the organization, and then real market of effectiveness.
All right, great. I love all three of them. Which one is it? Fair to say that one of them is your primary problem in a company and the others you're a little better at? Should I focus on one of these first or all three at the same time?
No, generally with our work, Jim, it's all about picking the one. You know, the book's organized around then these four big decisions. You've got to get right: full strategy, execution, cash. And look, if any of us are growing, you got problems in all four, but you have to choose the one to focus on first. That's why we've got this 4D assessment folks can do online to kind of figure out, all right, where do I start? And that's the key. Now, what are the next steps I've got to take in order to get over whatever hump I'm facing and continue to grow the company?
All right. Tell us about the one-page personal plan, please, Vern. How is that different from the business plan? What does it focus on in terms of my personal life? And is it only for business, or does it include religion and my kids and all that kind of stuff too?
Yeah, in fact, it's more the other stuff than it is business. By the way, it's designed around the same four decisions: people, strategy, execution, and cash. So we've changed it to personalize it. So people is really about your relationships. And we talk about what Jim Hansberg calls the 5S. Are you strong in your faith, your family, with your friends, your fitness? Then obviously finance is important, but it's the fifth. And most anyone, when they reach towards the end of their life, Jim found, I don't care what their wealth was, that those were the five major priorities in that order. And so we keep you focused on kind of how you're doing in those five areas. And so it's relationships, then it's your achievements, that's kind of the equivalent of strategy. Then it's your rituals, kind of our equivalent of execution, that date night you do. Tuesdays is my date night with my daughter, Jade. My wife and I every 6 weeks try to escape the four children and go someplace for a couple of days. You know, the family reunion you have once or twice a year, the time you spend with your five dear friends, these rituals that I think are critical, keep these relationships strong. And then obviously the last category is wealth. So relationships, achievements, rituals, and wealth. And it's all about long-term 2015. and what you're going to start and stop doing in the next 90 days. It's all on a sheet of paper.
All right. I love it. It's something that sounds like we desperately need to do it at this time of year. You've mentioned routine and ritual several times, and you talked about the 15-minute routine that you have every day. What's in that 15 minutes?
Well, and routines are critical. You know, everyone is going to be setting these goals and New Year's resolutions, and they fizzle out after about 3 weeks. And reality is, if you don't change your daily routine, goals are just hollow. Now, routines without goals are aimless, and so you need both. And so on this one-page personal plan, like our daily huddle for the company, there's really three kind of five-minute activities that I find will help you really drive your plan. First, 5 minutes of meditation. And I named one of the top five business books of 2014 in my venture column in Fortune. This book by Dan Harris. Dan's one of the ABC correspondents. And he wrote a book called 10% Happier. And his ultimate conclusion was, if you can just kind of focus on deep breathing for 5 minutes a day. You don't have to be meditating like, you know, the monks. But if you can get 5 minutes of just some breathing and focus on it, clear your head, that's useful. Then I've really fallen in love with this 4-minute Tabata exercise routine. This whole paleo diet, paleo exercise thing is caught on. It's this idea that really you only need to exercise 4 or 5 minutes, you know, a few times a week to get the equivalent of folks that kind of drive themselves crazy, you know, working out hours a week. I found that to be the case. So 4 minute Tabata. And then the power of gratitude. And taking a few minutes to kind of count your blessings, you know, journal if that's your thing. I've got kind of a breathing exercise that goes with that. And then I conclude, it takes about 30 seconds. This is the key. This is, if everyone could just do one thing, if every entrepreneur listening to this, Jim, could just do one thing, that is take this idea from Marshall Goldsmith, one of the top, you know, CEO coach in the world. And it's the power of having a peer coach, not a mentor. That's a different kind of relationship. This is a peer. And for me, it's my good friend Sebastian Ross here in Barcelona, has his own company as well. And we commit, based on our business and our personal one-page plans, 5 things. That's it. 5 things that we're going to do more of or less of every day in order to be a better father, be a better husband, be a better leader of our company. And what we do is we email each other every day. Marshall says call, but we've never made that work, so we just email each other every day, and we have to report, did we do it or not? And then we meet once a week, typically it's Friday at 11:15, where we're there just to kind of support each other, again, being a better, you know, entrepreneur, father, and husband. So one-page plan, and then do a little bit of meditation, do a little bit of exercise, and be grateful in reporting to your peer coach, 15 minutes. And I've never experienced anything that's moved the needle quicker for me, Jim, than that routine.
Great. I love it. And it's perfect at the beginning of the new year now for people to start. I love it. Bern, how can we find out more about you, buy your books, read your articles, get in touch with you, follow you on Twitter, all of that kind of stuff, please?
Just go to scalingup.com, and there we've got the one-page personal plan people can download for free, and instructions on how to fill it out for free, and this bonus chapter for free, and all of our tools for free. It's just all there to help out. And the book, if you buy a copy or two, that's helpful to explain how to do all of this as well. But just head to scalingup.com and hopefully sign up for my weekly insights. Every Thursday, I put out stuff to about 50,000 entrepreneurs that seems to be helpful to them.
Seems to be. Bern, thank you so much for being with us today. Great information. Hope you have fantastic holidays, and hope you'll come back soon.
You too, Jim. Thank you so much.
All right. We are out of time for today, but back tomorrow. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.